Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 7 of the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com. I'm your host, Brian Sippets, and you can reach me at HockeyStrengthPodcast@gmail.com. Feel free to contact me if you have questions about today's show or if you'd like to hear us discuss specific issues in future shows. Today, we'll be talking to HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com partner and National Team Development Program strength coach, Daryl Nelson. And also as a special guest, we'll be on the phone with Coach Anthony Donskov from Donskov Strength and Conditioning in Worthington, Ohio. On today's episode, we'll be talking about the use of heart rate variability and the rate of perceived exertion scores to determine athletes' physical and emotional readiness for training. In just a minute, we'll get on the phone with Coach Nelson, but first, in case you aren't familiar with HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com, it's a partnership between NHL strength coaches Sean Skane and Mike Potenza, USA Hockey National Team Development Program strength and conditioning coach Daryl Nelson, and Director of Athletic Development at Endeavor Fitness, Kevin Neal. At HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com, you'll find hundreds of articles, videos, programs, audio interviews, webinars, and lively forum discussions all geared towards improving performance of hockey players. So whether you're a strength and conditioning professional, a motivated player, youth coach, or hockey parent, HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com is the only training resource you'll ever need to produce healthier, stronger, more effective players at any level. New articles, videos, and programs are posted weekly, along with periodic audio interviews and webinars, and all of our coaches weigh in on the ongoing forum discussions. If you're new to HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com, you can gain instant access to our material for just $1 for the first 7 days. You'll be able to check out training videos, current programs, and articles from some of the best strength coaches in hockey, or even get advice from them in the forum. We're sure you're going to love the content, but if you're not completely happy with it, simply cancel your trial membership and you'll be out just $1. After the 7-day trial period, you can continue to be a part of the greatest collection of hockey strength and conditioning coaches on the planet for just $14.95 a month. You can also get 2 months free if you sign up for the entire year for just $149. Either option's an incredible bargain for so much material from these great coaches, so don't miss your opportunity to join them. All right, well, we got a lot to talk about today, so let's get on the phone with our first guest, Coach Daryl Nelson. All right, we're on the phone with Coach Nelson. He is the head strength coach at the USA Hockey National Team Development Program. He's got both the 17 and 18-year-old teams. And he works with them throughout the year and also throughout the summer. So glad to have Coach Nelson on the phone. Daryl, how you doing?
Great. How's everything going with you?
Not bad. I guess I'm getting fired up to watch some Olympic hockey and all the other sports, actually. It's nice to see athletes at that level.
Yeah, the Olympics are always really fun to watch.
I'm sure the NHL players are looking forward to their Olympic break. I know it's a nice time for those guys when they can get just an all-star break, for one, but they've got an extended Olympic break here, which gives them a little chance to recover and, get at the end of the season here. So it sort of brings up a conversation that you started on the forum here about heart rate variability. It's sort of been used as a way to measure physical readiness for players and, you know, to see if they're overtrained and that kind of stuff. Would you elaborate a little bit on heart rate variability and why you posed the question?
Yeah, it's becoming more popular, more prevalent, and people are using it. So I was interested to see if there's guys out there using it and how they're applying it and how they like it. I've never tried doing it with our teams. I think, partly because of like what people have talked about with logistics, the most accurate way to do is get a heart rate reading on a guy first thing in the morning. Well, with high school age players, it's not going to happen. They're not going to have a heart rate monitor with them or a way to do the thing, or they're going to be running late for school or whatever it is. Like, it's probably not going to happen. So, I think the discussion came out in the forum, a big problem with it is logistics. Now, if you're working with pro athletes or something like that, or if it's like some sort of special event where the team's together, like in a dormitory type setting, like a training camp or something like that, maybe that would be different. So I was interested to hear, just what people would say, about how they would use it and how they'd be able to pull it off. And So like I said, I never used it before. I wasn't familiar with it. From what I've read, is it's not really. It's kind of like everything else. Like all this thing with like functional movement and chronic injuries and stuff like that. It's not anything really that's new so much, but it's new to sports performance. You know, physicians have used heart rate variability to monitor patients that have like different kinds of like chronic diseases. You know, for a long time, and it's way less invasive than doing like blood tests and stuff like that.
Right. So some strength coaches are starting to use it. You know, from the guys that weighed in, Sean Skain weighed in on it, and so did Devin McConnell at UMass Lowell, and they're both using it with the team. And I guess the consensus with both of them is that it hasn't really changed exactly, or hasn't really changed how much they do things. It's more of they're sort of toying with it right now just to see how it applies. But it looks like the overwhelming response is that they're trying to use it, but at this point in a team setting, it's not really changing much of what they do.
Yeah. I think part of the conversation that came up was that, you know, coaches and teams that do a good job of managing their players and that are energy wise, I think are finding that, I guess the heart rate variability is reaffirming what they're doing. So I guess in that sense, it's really positive because it's putting an objective way to quantify, you know, what they're doing and how they're managing their team.
I guess, can we take a couple steps backwards here and talk a little bit about what heart rate variability actually is and what the readings actually mean?
My understanding of what's happening is, you know, you establish somebody's resting heart rate, and then basically that's kind of like a benchmark. And the more they deviate from that, you know, that initial heart rate reading that you take first thing in the morning, if they're not at their resting heart rate, they're working overtime. You know, they're in a state of overtraining, and the farther away they are from that baseline, the more overtrained they are. So essentially, it's a way to, I think what it comes down to, it's a way to monitor somebody's level of recovery.
Okay, yeah, and then you know, the other thing that I guess sort of popped into my mind is, especially if you have some teenage athletes, not only do you have the possibility of them forgetting in the morning or you know, not doing a period and not understanding the readings. Some of them, if they take their reading in the morning and they come up with a red, it almost gives them a free pass for the day. And, you know, there's only a certain number of athletes really that can handle the psychological part of that. If you come up with a red reading, which is basically tells you shouldn't be training that day, you know, how many athletes are going to have the maturity to, young athletes anyway, are going to have the maturity to take that in the right way?
Yeah, it's, if players could do stuff themselves, they wouldn't have coaches, right?
Right, exactly.
But I think, you know, again, like there's pros and cons to everything, and, you know, guys like Devin and Sean have talked about, you know, I think one pro that we're getting out of it is that it's reaffirming the way that they manage their team's energy and how their coaching staff is managing the team's energy. And so it's, you know, it's giving them, I guess you would call that positive feedback as far as what they're doing. You know, and the downside of that, you know, the other side of the coin is you have like a high school or a college age player and they decide, you know, just to say, well, we don't want to work out. We don't want to have practice, whatever. So F it. Let's, whatever, I'll stay up till 2 a.m. and, you know, I'll have a few shots of whiskey or I'll drink some beers or whatever. They know it's going to give them a red reading. And in reality, it doesn't have anything to do with the way the team was managed. It has the way to do with, you know, just didn't get enough sleep, basically. So you know, the other side of that, I think, is it's open to abuse.
Right. I think anytime you're getting into something that can definitely be manipulated by the players themselves, they can sort of tend to get what they want out of it. Along those lines, actually, we're going to be talking to Anthony Donskoff as our guest coach a little bit later on, and I'll be asking him about how they use rate of perceived exertion at his place. And so we'll see what he has to say. We'll see if, you know, players are generally being honest or if they're kind of abusing the system. All right, so just to switch gears here a little bit, you posted another question on the coaches forum that got a couple hits and kind of got some interesting conversation going. The question you posed was, what kind of background is ideal for a strength and conditioning coach, and is it important that he or she played the sports that they work with? You know, there were some mixed feelings on whether or not it was important to play the sport that that you're coaching, and also the sort of a review of the, or I guess an overhaul of the educational system is sort of being called for. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think pretty much most people I've talked with, they don't think it's necessarily important to have participated in the sport, on the sports that you work with per se. It's important that you probably have competed in something, you've done something competitive. I think beyond that, probably it wouldn't really matter. But as far as our education system, everybody I've ever talked about it thinks there should be more hands-on, whether it's, you know, like National Athletic Trainers Association requirements for our working hours before you're eligible for the exam, or, you know, more internship opportunities. Definitely something has to change. I don't know if, you know, one thing that was on there, people talked about having like a higher level of certification to the NSCA, and, you know, that requires like work experience, but I really don't think that would ever gain any ground, because then essentially that what that would do is it would just devalue the certifications that the NSCA already has. So I'm not so sure that would really be the way to go. You know, why would the NSCA do that? Then it would make your other certification obsolete.
Right. And even if it's just adding a little bit that requirement to the current standard, I mean, I look at, for me, you know, to be honest, what I learned in the NSCA is stuff that I don't really use, except for maybe a fraction of the physiology stuff. You know, the practical stuff, in practice, it's at this point, I guess, a little bit outdated.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess people, whatever you say, whatever you want, people have their opinions, you know, politically or whatever, but the system is the way it is because of the NSCA, so I doubt if they're going to provide a solution. You know,
right.
the thinking that causes a problem is never the thinking that fixes a problem. You know, no matter what you're talking about, like education or politics or, you know, like whatever it is, like I don't see that bringing about a solution. Maybe it's going to take another governing body, the NASM or something, to become a nationally accredited certification. You know, and them requiring more.
Right. See, I think it would, you know, for the NSCA, it should be a fairly easy fix. There's no shortage of internship opportunities. But at this point, everybody's charging, you know, $700, $800, $900, all the way up to probably $1,500 for just kind of an internship or shadowing weekend. Or, you know, there's plenty of opportunities out there. So really all it would be is, I guess, mandating it for the NSCA, and also maybe finding a way to help pay for it. But who knows? There's definitely no shortage of opportunity.
There's opportunities. I think what you get is if students are paying university for it, for credits. Like when I was an athletic trainer, I had to be, one of my semesters was I did an internship, and it was worth like 12 credits. So I paid for 12 credit hours.
Hmm.
To go and do my internship. Unfortunately, my faculty advisor was on board with the whole strength and conditioning thing, so I did my internship at, it was Sports Acceleration, but it was Mike Boyle Strength and Conditioning. And that's where I did my athletic training internship to fulfill my requirement for my degree. You know, that would be the simple fix. Then people wouldn't be, no one's going to charge students that are paying tuition to do an internship. You know, the same thing, I did an internship for my master's degree, and I did it at International Performance Institute in Florida, which was Mark Verstegen's place before he started Athletes Performance. He started International Performance Institute. And again, because my advisor was on board with the whole strength and conditioning thing, and they let me do a strength and conditioning internship to fulfill requirements for my degree. So I was able to get, you know, two pretty good experiences.
Yeah, I guess so.
That way.
And, you know, just to touch a little bit more on the point about should you have played the sport that you're coaching, there were some interesting points brought up, some about, you know, I guess I can see both sides of the argument here. It's just If you played the sport, you know a little bit more about where the players are, you know, at this time of season, how you feel, what goes on at certain times of the year, and all that kind of stuff. You'll pick that up as a coach as you go along. But some of the top coaches are not, you know, they didn't participate in the sport that they are currently coaching. Eric Cressy was never a baseball player. He was a tennis player, and now he's one of the top baseball coaches, strength and conditioning coaches, and you know, maybe knows more about the throwing shoulder than 99% of the people out there. So, you know, there's a couple interesting points there. You know, and you know, did you have a hockey background growing up?
Yeah. No, I never played hockey. I didn't know anything about hockey when I started working here. Nothing. I didn't know anything about it. No experience with it.
Right.
But I don't know. The coaches were definitely on board because they wanted a strength and conditioning coach. They wanted strength and conditioning. You know, I can't speak for people at pro hockey because I've never been around pro hockey. But particularly for this program here, you know, like everything that everybody does is pretty open. So, like, I literally knew nothing about ice hockey when I started working here. Like, I didn't even know all the rules. I didn't know all the rules. And so, like, but the coaches are always, like, that. How I learned about hockey was, like, when the coaches did video with the team, when they did meetings with the team, I'd go watch the video that the coaches show before and after practice. Like, that's how I learned about hockey.
Yeah, I think that seems to be the consensus, is that if you didn't play the sport, you really have to break it down and watch it and really pay attention to what kind of movement is actually going on. If you played the sport, there's a little bit of maybe the curse of knowledge there where you haven't really broken down the movement, so you can't really, you know what to do to prepare for a season. But when you haven't played it, you really have to take a good look at what movements are actually going on and design your programming around that.
Yeah, you can always draw, you know, similarities to other sports. You know, the way people move in different sports usually are pretty similar. And, you know, like you talked about, the curse of knowledge or whatever, or, you know, people aren't really stepping back and analyzing what they do. But, you know, how many people are still doing quick feet drills for ice hockey players?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we know that, well, it's a waste of time anyway. It doesn't actually make you faster. But then, like, for skating, the ground contact times are much longer than they are for running.
Right.
Puts in contact with the ice for a lot longer. And, you know, you can talk to have a conversation with somebody that played hockey for 30 years and they don't know that.
Right.
Because people just never take a step back and look at what's happening.
That's a great point.
You know, I know hockey coaches too, like I'll show them video of someone running on the ground and someone skating. And if you look at, like, if you start from a standstill, like how you accelerate, it's really similar. Like the first maybe four or five steps are pretty similar, skating and running. Then once you start striding and you start pushing really wide, then, you know, like the way a speed skater would skate, it's a lot different
right.
from running. But the initial acceleration is really similar. Well, in ice hockey, you spend a lot of your time accelerating.
Sure. Yeah, so we're training like sprinters, or should be anyway.
Right.
All right, well, I guess that'll about wrap it up. That's you know, that came up with a great conversation and a lot of good points by Kevin and Maria Mountain and yourself, and a couple other people also weighed in, but ended up being a pretty good thread. So, all right, well, thanks a lot for your time, Daryl, and we'll talk to you soon, and good luck with everything when the boys get back from Europe.
All right. Thanks a lot, Brian.
All right. Take care.
Yep, my pleasure.
Bye-bye. All right, thanks to HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com partner Daryl Nelson for taking the time to talk to us today. Next up, we have our guest coach, Anthony Donskoff from Donskoff Strength and Conditioning. Coach Donskoff is a guest lecturer, a frequent contributor to StrengthCoach.com and HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com, and has some really interesting articles about the physiological and psychological side of training. Today we're going to talk to Coach Donskoff about how he uses rates of perceived exertion to get the most out of his athletes every day. So let's go ahead and get on the phone with Coach Donskoff. All right, we're on the phone with head coach Anthony Donskoff at Donskoff Strength and Conditioning. Anthony, you're the founder and head strength coach at at your place there in Worthington, just north of Columbus. And how are things going there today? You a little chilly down there?
Yeah, it's been real cold here the last few days. We're just getting a warm front today, but we're thawing out, so everything's going well. Thanks for asking.
Good. I hope the school kids were able to make it in. I know we've had a lot of school cancellations and stuff like that, but hopefully your athletes have been able to make it in.
Yeah, we have. All good to go.
Okay, well, we just talked with Coach Daryl Nelson about his heart rate variability and how he started a thread that got a couple hits and gained some interest on the forum. And, you know, I just wanted to talk to you about a little bit of the same idea. You know, the whole idea behind the heart rate variability is that it's testing where athletes' bodies are at this point or at a certain point in time. And this time of year can sort of be, I guess, what I would call the doldrums. It's not quite close enough to the finish to see the finish line, and you've already been going for a long time, so it can get a little tedious here. And what I noticed is that with your athletes, you're using a rate of perceived exertion scale, so an RPE scale for your athletes. Can you expand on that a little bit and tell us how you use it?
Absolutely. Well, I haven't had an opportunity to read any of the thread on Daryl's forum, but for our smaller groups, our semi-private and our personal training customers, we too use HRV. We think it's a good, one of many biofeedback markers. And what we do with our HRV, and not to get off on different tangents, but I've made plenty of mistakes using it, and I've kind of learned as I've gone and gotten the advice of some pretty knowledgeable guys in the field like Patrick Ward and Joel Jamison. And we'll use HRV, and we'll use what we call our subjective stress score. So how we use HRV, we really look at it, our HRV in trends. So we give weekly loads. Obviously, if you're familiar with Joel's BioForce HRV, you know, you're gonna get your initial reading, and then from there you're gonna get, as you test your HRV on a daily basis, you're gonna get your three colors, you're gonna get your green, your ambers, or red, and those are gonna reflect your trainability for that day. So what we do is we put a number to each of those colors, as is mentioned in Joel's book. So a green would be a 1, an amber would be a -1, and a red would be a -2. So from there we look at weekly loads. So hopefully this not doesn't sound too confusing. If someone's got a -1 or a 1 or less, rather, they're very highly stressed for the week. If someone scores between a 1 or 2, they're a high stress week. 3 to 5, moderate stress week. And a 6 to 7, they'd be a low stress week. So, for example, that just gives us an opportunity to see, you know, number one, the trends in stress. And number two, it gives us a little bit better idea as strength coaches to individualize and dose the stress. I always like to say no two people need the exact same medication. Well, it's the same with dosing the athletes in terms of measures of the weights that we prescribe to them. So we do use HRV, but certainly in a big team environment, it really isn't applicable. Obviously we'd love to do that, but certainly not going to have, 18, 17-year-olds go out and be forced to buy an HRV system. So we do use subjective stress scores. And let me, Brian, if I may say, you know, we've done a lot of reading on overtraining. There's been some awesome books out there, and there's excellent information. One of the books that had a big influence on me was Overtraining in Sport by Kreider and Fry, and there's one other author, I think the last name is Tool, but I'll never forget one of the last things in the book said, subjective ratings of mood, fatigue, and stress and soreness may be our most cost-effective prevention strategy. And that's, that's coming from people that look at hormone profiles, blood work, et cetera, real fancy stuff that costs a lot of money to test. And in our environment, we don't have those resources. So for strength and conditioning, we do two things, and it's quite simple. We have pre-workout stress levels that each and every one of our athletes comes in and writes, and then we have an RPE, which is a rating of perceived exertion. So, for example, if you come in to work out at DSC and you're on an athletic development program or you're working out in a team environment, the first thing that you would do before you grab your workout or after you grab your workout will be to write your stress score. 1 is I'm feeling 100% ready to rock and roll, ready to tackle this workout, got great sleep, no soreness. 5, coach, I'm exhausted, I'm sick, I'm sore, I have no business being here, but I showed up.
So those are the two extremes of the measuring that we do. One being I feel amazing, five being I feel exhausted, and obviously in between two, three, and four are different variances of those extremes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
And then what we do, Brian, is at the end of a workout, we have what we call the RPE, the ratings of perceived exertion. And we're going to ask our athletes, you know, number one, same score as above, one through five. One, the workout was a breeze. I got through it. The weights that we used were relatively easy. Five being, coach, you absolutely thrashed me today. Okay, so from there we've got two subjective scores, okay, and we can use those to help dose our stress levels. So, for example, you know, if an athlete walks in and he is a four or a five on his pre-workout stress, we may have him look at his workout, or we as coaches would look at his workout, and take a look at a time when his RPE scores are a one or two. And we'd say, hey, Tommy, hey, Charlie, hey, Julie, we want you to load like this today. Okay? So we can use it that way, or we can just use the top-end pre-workout stress scores and just say, oh, you're a five today. Because we're in season, our volume's already dropped. So right. What we're going to do is we're going to tamper with intensity. I want you to take 15 to 20 pounds off your lift today. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I definitely get where you're going, and that can be really tough to implement, I think, in a team environment. But, you know, it seems to be, I guess, working out for you. In a team environment, then, how do you then group those together with similar stress levels at the beginning of the workout, or how does that work in a team environment?
Well, first of all, Brian, that's an awesome question, because, quite honestly, there can be many holes in implementing a process like this. And,
right.
And let me tell you the first hole, not having it a good atmosphere in your facility. And when I say your facility, obviously I'm playing the broad brush stroke here.
Right.
But the first thing you have to do is have athletes that are honest and that buy in. And I always say as strength and conditioning coaches, that's our responsibility to set that atmosphere. So, you know, I like to think as a strength coach that the athletes that we train at our facility, if they're five, they're five. I mean, they're not just going to BS me.
Right.
I take that at face value, and we put a lot of trust in our athletes, and we always tell them, you know, you should expect a lot from us, and we expect a lot from you. So we have had very, very, what I would consider zero to very, very minimal instances where I might think, yeah, I don't really know if that guy's
right.
So one of the things that we do is you know, we put a lot of trust in our athletes, and we expect a lot out of them, and that atmosphere is set from day one. But to answer your questions, no, we don't. We try to keep it as simple as possible, because many times when we're training our groups, or at least our teams, we've got two or three coaches and 18 athletes. So what we'll do is you know, especially at the end of season, the first thing we're probably going to do if we see these high stress levels is we're gonna manipulate intensity. So 15 to 20% of load potentially.
Okay.
Don't take 15, 20 pounds off your weights today, guys, because, again, it's in season and volume is already low.
Right.
I mean, when we're doing two sets of five, you certainly can adjust volume and only do one set, but we'd rather get the extra work in and tamper with the intensity first. As a secondary precaution, we might tamper with volume. And then last but not least, if a kid's coming in and he's that bad, I mean, he might just do a quote-unquote recovery workout for the day. We might say, hey, Tommy, hey, Joey, Ricky, you know, hop on the foam roller, grab a lacrosse ball, grab a softball. We're just going to roll. We're just going to regenerate, and we might do a little flush ride on the bike, and then you take off. So it's individualized in the standpoint that we don't bucket anyone, but we do have a standard procedure, if that makes sense. Intensity being the first procedure, volume, and then obviously a regeneration type flush.
Right, and that's kind of a big challenge for anybody. Yeah, working in the team environment, especially the finding that right dose, you know, for 18 different people, like you said, it can be 18 different doses. So that's definitely a great way to go about it, and you know, that's really, really tough to do. Have you found that it's tough on the, I guess, on the administrative side? How do you go about? Is it literally just about manipulating the weights for the day? You go through the same workout, you just manipulate the weight?
So truthfully, yeah. I mean, that's how we've gone about it. We've gone through the same workout. And again, the first thing we want to tamper with is manipulating the intensity and then the volume. And after that, I mean, we might just axe the workout for the day if it's really bad.
Okay.
And truly, and let me say this as well, because I've talked to several coaches, and I've, especially going back to HRV, I've made plenty of mistakes using HRV. I used to look at HRV and think red for the day, oh my gosh, throw the panic button, or amber for the day, oh my gosh, let's throw the panic button. I mean, HRV is based on basically keeping your heart rate within certain parameters. Too much above, too much below, and you're going to show an amber or a red. So instead of looking at it as a one-day type deal, at least with HRV, I want to look at trends.
Okay.
I want to look, if someone are red on Friday and then they show up again on Monday and are still red, then we got some problems.
Right.
Because there's some times as strength and conditioning coaches where we want our athletes an amber or red. We are going to, for lack of a better words, crush them one day. So I want to look at trends in HRV, and truth be told, with our subjective scores, we want to look at trends as well. Obviously, if someone shows up and they're just recovering from a cold or they're just recovering from some sort of sickness, they're going to go lighter. At the same time, we also want to look at trends. If that guy shows up next Tuesday and is still a 4 or 5, hey, I mean, what's going on here?
Yeah.
You know? And that might be a day where we say, hey, we're pulling the entire workout away from you. I just want you to roll, stretch, and just take off. Let's get you better first. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And you know, another thing that I think that would be tough, and I'm sure you've run into this as well, is you know, the reason for the stress may not necessarily be physiological. In fact, most of the time, it's probably not physiological. So how do you sort of tease that out where, you know, somebody's – you know, had a tough test at school or is breaking up with their girlfriend or something like that, and they have some sort of emotional distress that's holding them back. Does that typically translate to physiological, or is that just something that you call a high stress situation?
Yeah, we bucket stress as stress. And you know, you put your big stress buckets. Is it mechanical stress, you know, psychological stress? Lack of sleep? So we put it all in one big bucket because it affects the body the same way.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it starts at the hypothalamus in the brain and it goes all over the place and can cause systemic alterations in performance and fatigue. So one other thing we've been toying around, and we have not implemented it yet, just because the system we have for large numbers seem to be working. And quite frankly, I just get worried if we make it too difficult with large numbers, we're going to have ridiculous amounts of paperwork and confusion. But there was in this book as well, they talked about the four best predictors of overtraining: fatigue, muscle soreness, stress, and quality of sleep, right? So those are the big four that we're going to look at. And we might have, you know, they call a POMS or performance of mood states in the future where we, you know, rate a number of overall fatigue, 1 through 5. Rate an overall number of muscle soreness, 1 through 5. Rate an overall soreness overall systemic stress. And then how did you sleep that night? So that might occur in the future in our programs. We haven't gotten there yet just because I want to make that process, when we do implement it, efficient and streamlined. I don't want it, you know, there'll be 18 guys, you know, thinking they're taking an essay on physiology and stress. I want it to be an easy process.
Right.
As you know, working in large numbers, you know, if you can, the old KISS principle, keep it simple, stupid. So we've been toying around with that, but for right now, we bucket our stress all in one bucket, for lack of a better word. And again, it comes back to, for us, set the atmosphere. I understand that there might not be 100% buy-in. You might get one of 20 kids, you know, giving you a BS number. And typically, you can find those kids out well before they put stress scores down. And I think it's really isolated in our facility. I would like to think we have a pretty unique culture in our gym where young guys buy in and they're going to give us an honest assessment.
That's great. It sounds like quite a culture you've built. And, that's definitely something that, you know, if you have the culture, if you have the buy-in, like you said, that you can definitely use things like this. I think it's really impressive that you're using this. And I think it should be a model that a lot of other coaches follow. The old days of, going hard every day, you know, are done and gone, and the intelligent coaches are finding ways to get the most out of athletes each day, and you know, this is definitely a way to do that, where maybe they can't give you 100%, but they're at least giving you enough to cause some sort of change and get them better for the day.
Sure, it ties back to we have, you know, methods are many, principles are few. In our facility, we have several foundational principles that we adhere to, and one of those is the least effective dose. And it all comes back to the fact that, you know, for every substance, you know, a small dose stimulates, a moderate dose inhibits, and a large dose kills. And I always say, we as strength coaches, I mean, we're adaptation specialists. We prescribe stress, and anyone can crush somebody. That doesn't take a smart strength coach to do, right? You know, we've got to create an environment here where we're trying to dose individuals based on their body and based on their physiology, which is not an exact science by any means, and I would not argue that we're running that at our facility, but what we are trying to do is take that principle and apply it foundationally, and we've found a pretty simple way to do it. And it's worked for us, and we'll continuously work to refine it and make it a better process.
All right, well, we'll keep in touch, definitely, and find out, you know, the new systems you're using, how those are working, and until then, this seems to be working out pretty well for you, so good luck to you in the future, and hopefully we'll hear back from you, and we'll hear some new stuff that you got.
Awesome, Brian. Thanks for your time, and thanks to everybody on the site.
All right, thanks, Anthony.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, that's going to wrap up Episode 7 of the Hockey Strength Podcast. Thanks so much to our guests, Daryl Nelson and Anthony Dunskoff. Love talking to those guys. Love hearing what they have to say. Remember, you can access all these great programs, articles, and forum discussions that we talked about today at HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com. If you're not a member, you can join in the first 7 days for just $1. We hope you join us next time for Episode 8 coming next month. Remember to check in to HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com for everything you need to know about training hockey players. We'll talk to you next time here on the Hockey Strength Podcast.